Join us as we cover many an insane movie and numerous cult TV phenomenons. Are you ready to get jacked up? Are you with us? Then listen on.
Ladies and gents, Legion podcaster slash guest reviewer Ken Bates is here.
Howdy.
Alex Austin from the Ronin Geek OP podcast is here.
Greetings, thanks for having me on.
Anytime. Christopher Page from the Time Shifters podcast is here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Shit. Man, do I fuck up, and when I do. So then we got James Abinosh Jackson from Honest Reviews. How are you? And Jonathan Mark from the Action Elite.
Hello, everybody.
I'm just gonna circle around. Christopher, how did you get into Spielberg?
Probably the same way anybody did. By accident. Or on accident, whatever. He was just one of those filmmakers that, at the time that I was growing up, if it was a big film, it was likely a Spielberg film, at least in the prime teen years or so of my life. I think the first film I ever saw of his, without even knowing anything about directors or anything, was probably the first time I caught Duel on television.
Oh, perfect. Yeah. So you go way back to Antenna Channel.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And then from there, it was just more coincidence than anything, because it was just for the longest time through the 80s that if it was a big film that you wanted to see, it turned out it was Spielberg, behind it in one way or another. So I think that's how I came into him. I was never one to kind of go out and seek out a film just because of a director, but it was just so happens that so many of the films that I would seek out because I wanted to see were a Steven Spielberg film. I mean, that's the kind of the tall and skinny of it.
Absolutely. I mean, how else are you going to describe it? I mean, it's just a guy just larger than life, no matter the format. He was larger than life, just so happened to be on the small screen, and then he got bigger as he went along. So, I mean.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, so yeah, watching the TV movie that he did, and then next thing you know, in the mid-70s, Jaws is like the film that everyone talks about, and again, there's Spielberg, and I think that was the one that really kind of cemented his name as a name that you were going to hear for a while. Whether anyone knew was going to be for the next 50 years or not, I don't know, but people knew that Spielberg was going to be around to stay.
And I'm sure the security guards, you saw him sneaking into the Universal lot before he became a filmmaker, were like, yeah, this kid, he's got some guts. But yeah, no, it's true. It's like, it does make you wonder who knew he was hot stuff and who just took a while to convince, especially given how Jaws is basically a blueprint for every filmmaker. When you're not sure what's going on, just stay calm and figure it out,
Yeah, no, exactly. Mm-hmm. You read some interviews from some actors that have worked with him, and they all say, oh, as soon as I worked with him, I knew this was going to be the man that was going to be somewhere. But you always read those interviews that take place 10, 15, 20 years later. So you really wonder if that's what they say now, if that's really what they meant then.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is kind of fun just watching any earlier reviews or later reviews. And it always just makes you go, is like, okay, you know, were they hinting at something, or were they, you know, is this review really that outdated? Interview outdated.
I think there's just sort of you take kind of solace in the fact, if no matter how important you are, you know that there is some reviewer somewhere in the 1970s that said, yeah, this new guy, Steven Spielberg.
Spielberg! Podcasting After Dark had the fortune of interviewing Richard Tyson. And he was talking about, it was like, he knew he was going to be some hot stuff for a while the day Spielberg gave him $100. And told him to be in after school fighting flick. So it does say a lot how he's got all this rare confidence building on to various people. Okay, so Alex, I'll let you go next.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you. Over the years, I had seen Spielberg films when I was a kid, not having even known, you know, what Spielberg was. So, you know, earliest memories.
Who is this guy?
yeah, exactly. Like, and for me, it's just, you know, the films were just so eponymous with all of my favorite movies growing up. You know what I mean? So when it comes to, you know, E.T. and Jurassic Park and then later on Close Encounters and War of the Worlds, and just what an unbelievable resume he has. Every single thing he did, I mean, and I'm looking back over his filmography right now, trying to find something that wasn't, but I think basically everything he did was either a critical or commercial success or both. And just everything was just so far ahead of its time. Just
you can tell he made the proper calculations. And every once in a while, especially in recent years, I've seen people say, oh, I don't care for some of his historical movies. I'm like, well, here's the thing. He's not even doing a typical pedestrian historical epic.
Right.
You can't compare The Post or Lincoln to any other, you know, three-hour John Ford movie. You know,
it's just hard to even wrap my mind around the fact that, you know, here's a guy who put out, you know, Schindler's List in 1993 and then Jurassic Park in 1994. Like,
absolutely. Absolutely. I take it you guys have seen the HBO documentary about him from
the yes.
And I thought that was just, it did go deeper. It wasn't just a clip show. Liam Neeson did say the same thing he said on the directors years ago, where he's like, he's a painter looking, you know, painting his canvas and making sure all the right details are there. And I was just like, but I did like how they did discuss, you know, how he did all this serious stuff and it was rejected at the time because he's like, nah, you're the blockbuster guy. You know, you're not the important message.
Yeah, it
seems. And he's like, well, he has themes in even his blockbusters, like how science can prove you wrong in Jurassic Park. And then, of course, with Indiana Jones, you got the whole, you know, a strained father and going with your gut instinct on whether, you know, the archaeology dig, you know, goes to something greater.
Yeah, and arguably, you know, all of those talents, you know, his ability to direct, you know, a large cast and a large setting with large sets and everything is just so big. I mean, all of that also aided him when he did the dramas, you know, your Schindler's List and your Amistad's and things like that. I think all of it really lent itself well to those types of films when you get down to it. It's interesting to see how those talents just bridge back and forth to straight up blockbusters, to dramas, and then back again. It's wild.
Absolutely.
So yeah, that was kind of my journey with Steven Spielberg. And all the major ones are in there. All your, you know, your Indiana Joneses and you know, War of the Worlds and freaking Munich was. I'm just looking down the list right now. It's just unbelievable what this guy has to his name. So. Brilliant.
Absolutely. And we'll get to all our various theater encounters with him for sure. Ken, I'll let you detail.
I got a confession to make, you guys. I kind of messed up. I watched all of his non-union Mexican equivalent movies, Señor Spielbergo. They were good. No, I honestly, I don't remember a time where Steven Spielberg wasn't someone who I knew.
Particular days, Spielbergo. Yeah, I don't know.
I've always been a movie fan. I mean, I think my father took me to see Empire Strike Back when I was two. And somehow, I don't know, he talked to me about Jaws a lot before Jurassic Park came out. I was way too scared to watch Jaws. I'm sorry, before E.T. came out. And somehow I just knew the name Steven Spielberg. I knew how movies were made. And then in 1984, they had this awesome behind-the-scenes documentary about the Temple of Doom. Oh, nice. On PBS, and my dad recorded it for me, and I watched that, you know, before Temple of Doom was on VHS, I watched that over and over and over, and a couple years ago, I rewatched Temple of Doom, and I said, wow, this movie is how I kind of understand the film medium, because I saw how it was all put together.
Absolutely. I miss those days, too, where you had to actually stay after the credits for a special feature.
This was on PBS, and it is on YouTube. I watched it again recently.
Oh, nice. Temple of Doom. Damn. That is good. And it does kind of just make you just reevaluate any kind of movie, or whether you like it or not, still at the end of the day. It's like, okay, well, you can't say it was, you know, forced or without some serious effort. And I think, yeah, he did kind of just show how it can be larger than life while at the same time how it's a passion and you know what you want to do. And, you know, 84 is already a big year, you know, when he's producing so much stuff and directing, again, two blockbusters a year. So it's like, man.
Yeah. And all the producing and writing and.
Basically, Roger launches Joe Dante and, you know, Robert Zemeckis' career even more, goes to Tobe Hooper of all things for Poltergeist. It's like, man, set for life.
I've just always been a fan. I'm really happy. This podcast, I went out and rewatched all his recent stuff, which I hadn't really paid attention to. So I'm all caught up. I've seen all of Steven Spielberg and Señor Spielberg's films. So,
woo!
Diamonds.
Perfect, perfect. Alrighty, James.
Can you guys hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, cool. I was having some mic issues. I apologize. Okay. Yeah, when it comes to Steven Spielberg, I mean, this guy just has like the Midas touch. I mean, we all, you know, everything he touched turns to gold. I might be a little younger than a lot of you guys, but I mean, every movie that I was a kid that I fell in love with, from like Gremlins to Artificial Intelligence, I would just watch over and over. And as you get older and you just watch a lot of movies, you start to put a trend, like every good movie I've watched, I hear the name Steven Spielberg, you know, and in the range in which the movies I've watched is crazy. And I believe like just recently I was watching, I don't know if you guys seen like Terminal.
Oh yeah.
And I was like, who can make a movie about a guy stuck in an airport and make it good?
That's exactly what I thought. I always just kind of didn't really pay attention to it until this podcast. And I was like, damn, that was really good, actually.
Yeah. And I wasn't convinced I'd seen it at first. I avoided the theater because some critics were being some total just Scrooges about it. And I was like, you know, that was actually kind of intriguing. And it's, I'm wondering if that got Zoe Saldana, her role as Uhura in the Star Trek reboot, because she does a, you know, LeBlanc and Prosper Vulcan signal in there.
I forgot she was in it, actually.
Yeah, that, a year after Pirates of the Caribbean, she's in that. We'll do an episode on her. But no, that's a very good point. I can't think of any. I've seen people who haven't seen some of the big blockbusters just because their parents suck, but I've never seen anyone who hasn't seen any movie by this guy. And just, it is kind of definitely a rarity, because he not only had such quantity and quality, and then just doing so much other just side projects. It's like he just understood the business, I guess you could say, and he understood what he wanted to do and what people weren't going to see. The fact that he even convinced Joe Dante is like, hey, you got to change the ending of Gremlins.
Yeah.
And Dante obliged, because he's already down to work with Spielberg, because he understands that, you know, he's like, hey, the guy at least had a sense of humor and hired me because he saw my Jaws knock off Piranha because it was the best one. And basically, the only people Dante doesn't get along with are just Warner Brothers executives.
and much like Dante, Spielberg loves film. He's always loved film.
Pretty much. He's always... anyone who I've heard work with him, has never said, has always acted like everyone is important. He never acted like, yeah, I'm the guy calling all the shots here, kid. You know, none of that. You know, sweep the leg, and you know, everyone else, you know, is expendable. None of that. And so I think that is kind of unique. It's like, okay, so you've earned it. you're not the guy who's got a cool word, and then it's just unpleasant to work with at the end of the day. None of that. So.
Isn't it refreshing, especially in today's world with all the news stories that come out about our favorite directors or our favorite actors, that we all love these films, and then it comes out that, oh yeah, but he was actually a real cad on set, and he did this and he did that. And you never hear that from Spielberg. And in fact, anything, it's the opposite. You hear more and more, you know, you think, oh, he must've been a real bear. No. Oh no. I mean, people will come to his defense.
The closest I ever got was Corey Feldman was going on about being molested in the industry, and someone kept making rumors. Oh, it's either Joel Schumacher or Spielberg. It's like, and to be fair, those guys were rather radical nutters. So it's like, that's as close as you're going to get. It's like, he's already explained who it was that molested him, and then he's changed the story five different times.
isn't Steven Spielberg from Ohio?
Yeah, Cincinnati native. Thank you.
Yeah, that's probably why he's such a great director. That explains it all. Okay. All great things are from Ohio.
He gets you, man. Alrighty.
Those formidable first 10 years of his life right here in the Queen City.
Weeps. Alrighty. Danny boy.
Well, it's basically been said, like, you could not be the child of the 80s and 90s and not have seen a great deal of his work. You know, Close Encounters, E.T., Jurassic Park, the Indiana Jones movies, and but I tend to prefer some of the more obscure stuff myself, like the aforementioned Duel, which is a favorite of mine, and one that seems no one's heard of, Twice Upon a Time, even though he didn't direct that, he produced it.
Oh, yeah, with, like, John Nordy or somebody, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, very true. He did so many other side projects, and I was always drawn to them, let alone anything Industrial Light and Magic was doing effects for, and it seemed like video stores just started getting just lame. Like, they just, after, like, 96, they just started getting rid of all the obscure stuff. Going with all the easy stuff that everyone had already, you know, bought multiple times. It's like, god damn it, I want to watch all the obscure stuff.
And of course, the Cyndi Lauper video for Goonies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know how to get her out.
Oh, wow. Deep cuts.
Deep cuts. And it is kind of funny how you can tell if his name's on it, you know, it's either a franchise that he originated. He's basically tied for Van Damme for person with the most movies that he's originated that everyone's done multiple sequels to. With or without their involvement. We swear, he was not involved with the Poltergeist and Jurassic Park sequels.
Well, the second Jurassic Park.
Yeah, second Jurassic Park.
Right, in which he later tore a new one saying, yeah, it's not all that great a story.
No. And I'm sorry, but I will forever see that one South Park episode about the last Indiana Jones movie.
What do you mean? Last Crusade was awesome.
Hey, Indiana Jones, exactly. What you do in our parks?
We wish that was the last one.
There's only three Indiana Jones movies.
Only three, I agree.
There's only three that I've seen.
Yeah, and that's not counting the TV show, the video games, and the upcoming commercials. The fifth one claiming to be the fourth one. I guarantee you, James Mangold probably hated the last one, and he's like, zero references to the last one.
Hopefully.
Related note, I'm seriously convinced the only things keeping Harrison Ford alive at this state are marijuana, flying, and just sheer hatred.
Probably is. Keeping his kids in line.
He makes no attempt to hide the hatred.
I mean, I don't know. What would you do if you were married to Alec McBeal? Oh, God, moving on.
Probably end up having a son like Kylo Ren.
Ooh, nice.
Oh, God. Okay, John, next. What's your intro to the school?
Well, like we've all said, I'm actually one because of my older brother. he's the one that actually introduced me to ones like Jaws, Jurassic Park, and especially the Indiana Jones trilogy. That's what really got me to love him as a filmmaker all these years. And then later on is when I discovered all his obscure stuff like Amistad and Munich,
which I
did not know was one of his films until many years later. And he's always been one that I've always appreciated, even if it's some I'm not a big fan of, which I'm sure we'll mention sometime soon. And to me, it's very rare when he makes a bad one. I mean, there are some, trust me, like I said. And to me, he's one of a kind, and we just don't have that much of that anymore, especially with certain directors.
Oh, no. But I mean, to even have a video game based off your, movie-making adventures is like, he basically was embracing every kind of thing. I knew people who knew his name just because, how can you not when his name is at the beginning of every Animaniacs episode?
That's true. Yeah, Tiny Toons.
Yeah, it's like he was embracing every kind of property, even older Warner Brothers stuff and all this other Universal spectacles. And
Related note here, actually, about 2 years ago, I think it was, when they announced there was going to be new Tiny Toons, I had to let my brother know because he loved that show as a kid. And I sent him a link of one article, and he said, I didn't realize Spielberg was involved. That explains why it was so damn good.
And I mean, it just keeps continuing, just producing, Clint Eastwood's World War II movies, and then every other TNT spectacle miniseries is like he's embracing all of that and is still just, I wasn't surprised.
HBO series?
Oh, totally, yeah.
Band of Brothers, good stuff.
And then Men in Black is like, yeah, of course he.
Oh, yeah.
Was one of many people who said, let me get you involved with some people I know who totally understand your vision. And then seeing his cameos for the longest time, I just would guffaw. Is like, he's in Austin Powers.
Yep.
Blues Brothers, my God. I mean, so go figure. So I'll just circle around. Alex, what are the pros and cons of Spielberg? Like, you can talk about his more underrated movie or... And then his a bad movie he's done that doesn't get enough hate.
I think the pros are pretty outstanding. I mean, there's so much to draw off of. I mean, from visual effects, he's pioneered so much in the industry. From the scale of his films, I think he relies on scale a lot and scalability of what you're watching, and that's what really makes it so exciting. I think sometimes, and it's happened. War of the Worlds comes to mind, where the vision might just be a little bit too big and just kind of overtake, the drama that's happening in the background or the actors and the performances they're trying to put out there. So I think he has been guilty of that in the past, and it works really well in some settings. If you look at, Jurassic Park and the wild things that happened in, the two films that he was involved with, or Indiana Jones was a film that struck a great balance, particularly The Last Crusade, which is like my top three favorite films of all time. I just think it's unbelievably brilliant. So it's just interesting that he has such a wide range of
No, very well, very well said.
I appreciate what you're saying.
He never gives up. He has like three themes going, like adventure with some family connection, historical epic, World War II for the most part, and then kind of a Frank Capra kind of drama throwback, and then like you say, just aliens. Just ever since Close Encounters in E.T., he does play on that whole alien thing, whether it is, Taken miniseries or, Falling Skies and dinosaurs even, I guess you could say, are kind of in the same kind of spectrum. That's a very true thing too. And you can tell he just gets with all the kinds of museums and everything. And he's kind of done that since Schindler's List, where he was reopening various, all that money he made off it, he contributed to just like Jewish research for, Holocaust survivors and other stuff. Mm-hmm. Is just so unreal. It's like, okay, so you can't say he's a guy who didn't give back in some capacity. He's giving you some knowledge before he gives you the escapism, and then, tries not to preach too much to you.
I think it was interesting, Schindler's List, and like you said, his work with a lot of Jewish communities and centers and stuff like that was him rediscovering his Jewish roots. He was born a Jew, but kind of walked away from Judaism because he was effectively ostracized and picked on as a young child. And he was sort of embarrassed of to be a Jew. And so around that time was when he started, you know, having a family of his own, decided to raise his family as practicing Jews. And that was him rediscovering his religion and rediscovering his past. And that was his way of sort of, I think in a way it was his way of sort of apologizing for turning his back on it all those years.
I think I have seen kind of narratives like that in various other articles on it. And that's so true, because it's like, he was the guy who, you know, his parents were away working and divorcing, and I was just putting a toll on him, to where he's like, okay, I just want kids to come over and play around with the 16mm, you know, build a train set and just, you know, I'm the geek, you know, before anyone knew what that word is, you know.
Yeah, he said in that doc, he really only felt like a real person when he was behind the camera.
I think a lot of filmmakers do kind of get that too. So he's like, when you see some of the greats kind of misspeak in an interview, it's like, yeah, they want to go home, drink some wine, hang out with their family, and then only be annoyed when they're, you know, at work, which is, you know, making something that other people, you know, their only reward other than the money they make opening day, you know, is their other than their salary is just seeing people react to it. And when something doesn't take off in the theaters, that's always going to get them, because they're just like, what do I say? Do I say the audiences are stupid and risk, you know, dividing my fan base? Or do I just fess up and say, yeah, I'll try again if someone will give me the money for the next project? Yeah. Not everybody can be like Milos Forman, where you make movies that resonate with both audiences and critics and yet don't make any bank, you know? You definitely can say he had all bases covered, because he just somehow, he was an entertainer first and he's a businessman second, but he always knew, is like, okay, this is how we're going to market it. This is how it's going to open. This is what's going to get people, you know, to see these kinds of movies. It's definitely kind of unheard of nowadays. You still see some people as like, who we all love, and yet they're still being utilized, and yet people are still complaining, yeah, you're not making any money for us. Oh, so, James, tell us some other fun stories.
I think, you know, as great as he is, you know, he does have an Achilles heel.
We all do.
Yeah, we all do. And his Achilles himself, it may be just that small, but I do think we all know his pros. I think his biggest con is maybe he doesn't think anything's too big for him. And with a guy with such a big imagination or a big plan to make movies, when you give him a broad scope movie, you kind of watch it and you're just like, I don't know why I'm watching this. For example, like War of the Worlds was like classic one, Minority Report, you know, like he has movies where, or like The Adventures of Tintin, where it was just like action packed, but it was like, what's the story? You know, I see all the action and things going on, but what's the story? So I think that's his biggest things. I think his strength is when you tell him, or when he thinks of something, of a story and a person, which is maybe why he always cast Tom Hanks, because Tom Hanks is kind of like the most interesting, boring actor I know. But I think that's
true.
Why, I think that's why he loves Tom Hanks, because, you know, if he cast like Tom Cruise, I'm not a fan of Tom Cruise, but it's Tom Cruise movies. Tom Cruise is a guy who wants to go big. And, you know, you got Steven Spielberg, another guy who wants to go big. And every time I watch that duo, that tag team between those two, I'm just always like, maybe we can focus more on the story and less on the action.
And those are like some of the few people where it's like, even in those two movies, like, I don't even see Tom Cruise for once.
Yeah.
Everything else, it's him running. It's like, well, he runs a lot in those movies, but I'm not seeing Tom Cruise running.
Yeah.
For a change. But yeah, it is kind of wild. I've seen people who complain about movies being kind of just Saturday morning cartoons and nothing else to it. And I saw so many of them praising Tintin. I'm like, really? That has a lot of the cons that you complain about typically, but I understand that it kind of, it basically hit its fan base, which was, you know, a collab between him and Peter Jackson adapting a, you know, comic book, comic strip serial. And this is like, yeah, but, I guess you could say, in recent years, Crystal Skull is the only one that's kind of just an internet punching bag.
True and story.
For Nuke the Fridge to be a new phrase, that says something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Most definitely.
Can't say he didn't leave his mark.
Wow.
Back in the day, I do recall, out of all his own TV show productions, I guess the only one that I've seen be mocked back in the day and yet everyone watched still was Sequest.
Oh, Lord.
That was a show with a lot of potential.
And it's just like,
that was not realized very quickly.
Yeah, and it didn't help that Roy Scheider was like, hey, I'll get Roy Scheider from Jaws. And he's like, Roy was on the record saying, I fucking hate that show.
He ended up hating, not to go down too far of a rabbit hole or anything, but I discovered that show on some streaming platform, NBC's thing or something like Peacock, that. Yeah, Peacock. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to watch that again. I remember kind of liking it. And the first half of the first season, there was a lot of potential. And then you can see where the studio started screwing with it.
Wait till you get to the Bill Shatner as a Russian episode.
Yeah, been there, and that's not too far after when I stopped. And that's when Roy Scheider started really disliking it. He wanted it to be the sort of
Star Trek kind of, like,
well, teach a lesson about the environment and the ocean and messaging, all that stuff. Yeah, the message program. And about halfway through the first season, you know, you could tell the studio started getting involved and like, no, let's have aliens. And that's when Roy Scheider was like, I'm out.
Replace him with
Michael Ironside.
Yeah, he was
guy from ER.
Forced. He was forced into the second season. And then, yeah, as soon as he could bolt, he did. And that's, I think I'll stop there. That's a whole nother show.
No, that's fine. And I remember me and my sister watching the Minority Report show. It's like, you think this would be great. And then it's just next thing you know, a great cast, you know, and none of them have any characters. They're just all just doing their best CSI imitations, but not even that kind of cheesy level. It's just like, okay, so unrealized potential. This is two commercial breaks in. I already want to stop this. And then I saw other people realize it because it got launched on Netflix a few years back. I was like, do not bother. Play the video game if you must have more of that world, but do not watch that show, because this is like, it's just so easy to not have realized potential. And I can't blame him for wanting to make it a show, because he was attached to all this stuff at one point or another. And I remember Under the Dome was kind of the next Lost or poor man's Walking Dead for a while. But everything else, I do think, like you say, he does kind of invest some heavy talent into it. I recall years ago when Extant, this Halle Berry sci-fi show, was picked out of his people at Amblin caught part of a screenwriting competition, and they instantly said, hey, you know, we make this a show. So I think he does have some pretty competent people who look for some serious stuff that can kind of appease all kinds of crowds. And it seems like, other than, like you say, my uncle, when I told him about Peacock streaming Sequest, he lit up saying, I want to rewatch that. But yeah, there are other people who's like, you know, like you say, it is kind of a disappointment. And On the Lot, I remember, was kind of just a I'll see you later there. On the Lot was kind of one of those that should have been a big fun competition show. Who wants to be the next filmmaker, you know, with him as a judge? And it's like, for whatever reason, it's just like the production crew in a rare attempt just screwed it up, and they just kept rescheduling it on Fox. And it was just like, what the hell happened to it? I never saw any of it. I just only saw the Entertainment Weekly gossip about it. And it's like, what happened to this show? It's had those misses, like you say. Ken, I'll let you. Actually, think... no, James and Ken, I'll let you two go. Finish up.
Okay, I'll go. I think that Steven is, if I know him, Mr. Spielberg's, one of the thing, his basic attractions can also be one of his biggest weaknesses, and that's the schmaltz. You know, it works great in the scene in Jaws when the young Brody is imitating his father, but like, I couldn't get through War Horse, man. I tried.
I saw it, but I wouldn't say it's his strongest. I just was at least applauding him for approaching World War One. But I will say it does get a little Disney-esque with the whole, you know, don't kill the horse bit in the end. But I can't blame you. You know, it's a like it or hate it movie. But no, that is true. He does kind of anything that he has, at least you'll see always see once just because there's some good shots and talent involved. I applaud him for always improvising with his kids because even he knows that, hey, you know, no one knows how to write for kids. You know, kid actors aren't always the strongest when they start out. And just always kind of improvising with them, just orchestrating his own conversations. That's like as much as he deviates from the scripts.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so John and Daniel, I'll let you guys just kind of just talk about just some other ups and downs.
Well, I actually admire Case's examples where he took source material that it was good, but he made it better. Jaws and Jurassic Park are probably the best examples. You know, Jaws, honestly, it's a god-awful book. It's just terrible.
Yeah, it's pretty never read it. Probably
it's funny. It's funny. I never knew it was a book until years
later.
Yeah,
I never knew it was a book.
Yeah, like, you're not vested in any of the characters. They're way less likable. You're practically rooting for the shark half the time, which, you know, he had to make alterations to up the drama and,
yeah,
you know, Hooper spoiler bangs alert, Mrs. Brody. spoiler alert, Hooper has an affair with Brody's wife.
That's right.
Yeah. Psychosomatic, who Ken and I know, chronicled it pretty well. How is like, it's pretty much a political thriller with some creature attacks. It's like,
yeah, exactly.
Well,
wow.
There were several subplots that just distracted from it. And with Jurassic Park, it's a good book, particularly if you're a science nerd, but there's too much science jargon. It drags it down a lot. There's too many characters, mm-hmm. too many subplots. Crichton is very full
of himself when you let him off his leash, and he knew how to just rein him back in. And it's just like you say, I mean, I knew a lot of people who praised The Lost World, and I remember reading that book and just, after a few pages, just being like, okay, so other people are dying, and the story's becoming a little distorted to me. It's losing me because it's just nonstop, again, chases without any investment, like you say. And the first book was cool from, like you say, a sci-fi thriller. And once you got past the Tom Clancy-esque dull descriptions.
True.
Like you say, there's other Crichton books that should totally be movies or miniseries, but they just haven't done yet. But I do like to say, like hitting on that, I do like how he knew what compromises to make and just have Jaws and Jurassic Park kind of recreate the creature feature. Make it be more than just a so bad it's good or goofy movie. It's like, now there's something for everybody. You got to have some humor. You got to have a despicable character get killed at the end. And then you got to have some other just cool terror and escapism and adventure. Bonus points for having Dr. Grant dress up like Indiana Jones multiple times.
But I will also acknowledge... Sorry.
Go ahead.
I'll also acknowledge a drawback to his, and I said it before, the man could be an absolute whore at times. Like, you know, stuff that's like, seriously, man, why are you putting your name on this? You know, he's doing it for the money.
It's true.
Yeah, it's like, never, kind of a quote Brent Spiner from Star Trek, and is like, I remember him in a funny interview just saying, there are plenty of times where certain Jack Warner never showed up on set. I'm like, yeah, there's plenty of stuff where, yeah, executive producer Spielberg is like, yeah, and as involved as he was a phone call meeting.
Yep.
And telling people why it works and giving them their blessing and telling the other guys, you know, just leave them alone. Gonna check up on you, but like you say, there are times where he's pretty much a Joel Silver type, where he's just, this should be bigger, and yet it's just not. Just given the, you're giving the talent too much freedom, and then you, like you said, you know something's wrong when there's not even an interview of you promoting the movies. You know, because he does do that every once in a while. It's like you're seeing him promote a movie because virtually no one else is known in the cast and crew. It's like he is the courier, he is the transfer guy. He's the messenger. What do we think about the BFG? Because I didn't see that in the theater because it just looked too kid-friendly.
I did see it in the theater, actually.
It was all right, I guess, but it...
Yeah.
It's not really... It feels like something he would have made back in the 80s when he was first starting out, but it doesn't have as much of the intrigue as E.T. or... I don't know.
But... Yeah,
the most I can praise is cinematography. That's about all I can say about that.
Yeah, and I'm so glad that he keeps giving Janusz Kaniewski, you know, the ability to keep launching his career. And yet, Memoirs of a Geisha didn't really take off. And yet, anytime I see Janusz Kaniewski trying to do another movie where he's in the director's chair, you know, and maybe even still the head cinematographer, is like, well, best of luck, because you need some more material. You know how to lens all of Spielberg's movies and make them. Did anyone ever see Always?
I did.
Right now. I did.
That was like where he first really went into Frank Capra homageville.
Most definitely.
Yeah.
And I have tried to rewatch it a few times. I still have not been successful, but I'll do it one of these days. But it's one of those, like, you would think a plane crash and...
It's pretty dull.
Yeah, that's about the right way to describe it. Yeah,
because it's a big cast too. It's like Holly Hunter, John Goodman, and Richard Dreyfuss. So Jaws reunion there is like, come on, fuck. I guess you could say The Terminal and Catch Me If You Can were like his best Frank Capra kind of tributes. Because it's like,
yeah,
any other time he just got, like you say, too self-indulgent, or as James was saying, just too big to fall, and yet he still fell. I'll just say this: 1941 is the only movie I just absolutely cannot stand. I refuse to go back to.
I was actually going to mention that one because.
Okay, please tell us more because you've told us before how, you know, AI is disappointing. Twilight Zone, the movie has a few installments that aren't as interesting, but yeah, that, you know, Hook has some adventure despite some overacting. But it's like, yeah, 1941.
That's a gigantic mess. That's what I like to say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, big cast.
With a big cast. And that's why I went to watch it, because I went, oh my God, Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi in a Spielberg movie? I want to see that. And then you watch it and you go, oh God, no. Why?
I had wanted to see it years ago. And then other people in my family rented it from the video store when I was already kind of being like, yeah, I'm just going to watch Spielberg's newest stuff. I've seen most of his older stuff. And it's like, I kept walking out multiple times. It's like,
same here.
Yeah, I got it for this podcast, and I felt like I was watching a foreign movie with no subtitles. I was like, is this movie in English? I literally do not understand what is happening or what anyone is talking about. And then we saw Nancy Allen and Garters, and that was okay. But that was it.
Yeah, she was.
Yeah.
She and the cast really do their best, but it's just like, despite the stunts and everything, is like, at the same time, he did need that. He did need a slap on the wrist.
Oh yeah. I have a friend who swears by it because he grew up with it. So.
Oh yeah, my uncle will definitely buy a Blu-ray if he had the money. Like you said, the same one who swears by Sequest. So it is interesting how a lot of his lesser movies still have some kind of cult audience. But like you say, that kind of around that same time is when he got close to Bob Zemeckis, and he knew when to kind of rein himself in a bit before he occasionally would slip here and there. And I wouldn't be surprised if West Side Story flops, and I wouldn't be surprised if it wins all the awards this year and is a crowd pleaser, you know?
Yeah. Maybe he's just a big hit or miss, you know, guy. More hits, but if he's going to flop, man, he's going to flop hard. Because, 1941 gave me, like, Airplane vibes. If Airplane was, like, really trash. You know,
I was gonna say,
like, that's literally what it gave me. And
definitely inspired by the National Lampoon.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wasn't he working with John Landis on that one? I could be wrong.
Possibly. They were buddies back.
I think so.
Pre-Twilight Zone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was wondering if maybe you have to take it with
that was
the...
Zemeckis, my bad, who wrote it. Thanks, Zemeckis.
I'm wondering if
his film debut, good God, it didn't get better from there, did it?
No.
I do wonder if you have to kind of take it with the time in which it was made. I mean, he was still a relatively young, and despite having a couple really big hits under his belt with Jaws and Close Encounters of the Third Kind, he was still kind of experimenting and trying to find his real place. And I'm sure he didn't want to be pigeonholed into the horror or sci-fi. And so 1941, I think, was just him maybe dipping a toe in a water in a pool that he wasn't familiar with. And yeah, obviously with mixed results. And
makes you wonder if that's what he did producing at the time. He's like, he saw how easily they could bury him if they really wanted to. And so he's like, instead of risking being out of work, he's like, I'll take some other people who I think can do it better than me. I don't have to do everything.
It's probably really lucky that he had Jaws and Close Encounters under his belt, because I think 1941 probably would have killed his career if he had.
Most definitely.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
I agree.
Someone gave him the chance to do Raiders of the Lost Ark. And then I'm pretty sure when that happened, 1941 was okay. We'll let that one slide.
If that had been his first flop after Jaws, he totally would have been buried. But since he had that, Close Encounters and Sugarland was a critical darling and he had killed on TV, mm-hmm. he had options. He had people whose minds he had picked. And so yeah, had it been number two, it would have been just that, number two. It's like,
everybody
don't
gets
forget
one.
Jaws was, nobody expected the hit like that.
It took him even years later to start adapting Peter Benchley's work. They just started realizing, yeah, we got to just do it for TV, have it be a miniseries event. I'm surprised he never revisited Benchley. He's like, yeah, it's not gonna get any better with him from there. So yeah, just
yeah, because honestly Benchley sucks.
Hey, the island's great.
Oh good. And so how do we feel? Color Purple, it did take me years to rewatch because it was just so depressing. It's such heavy material, you know. And
yeah, same
I was,
here.
I was glad I did.
Yeah, all my life I had to fight.
Started the Oprah connection there. You've never seen Danny Glover be such a, you know, vicious villain. That almost makes me wonder if Django Unchained, that's what Sam Jackson character basically is, just a former slave who basically decides to treat his entire race like garbage. It's cool that he's made movies for every kind of audience, you know, and Empire of the Sun was kind of his first venture back into World War II again, other than Indiana Jones, and that one blew me
beautiful
away right
film.
Away.
Yes. And Aviation, too.
There you go. And once you get over Christian Bale being a whiny bitch.
that movie alone, I think, started my love affair with the P-51.
You're right. And doesn't it make a cameo near the end of Private Ryan during the village bombing?
I don't know.
It saves them, I believe.
Yeah.
Right. And I remember some historians.
So.
Like
the Cadillac of the Sky.
Yep.
Cadillac of the Sky. But yeah, I remember... Yeah, best movie where Vin Diesel is actually tolerable.
True.
I remember some trivia guys going so far as to say that bomber would rarely, you know, go in for that kind of a bombing raid. And it's just like, fuck you. You don't know what kind of bombing. It's a bomber. This is what the model they used. And man, man. But I guess you could say early on, he kind of was thinking like all the other TV producers like Dick Wolf or Stephen Bochco. He's like, okay, so I got to round up all the other talent that I know, put in a word for them, and help launch their careers, because the industry can't just be just me. I got to take the pressure off a bit.
Maybe that's a little bit of him doing the giving back, too. The industry gave him a lot, and so he's trying to turn back and give other people, you know, the same opportunities that he had.
He definitely loved Charlie Chaplin kind of movies, so he wanted some of those kinds of comedies, and then he wanted some other kind of just, you know, Treasure of the Sierra Madre. It's very sad that not as many people have seen that, but they've seen all the other Bogart and John Huston classics. I'm like, no, you should see that regardless of whether are not you're familiar with Indiana Jones. And in which case, if you're not familiar with that, we're not even going to start the conversation. But it's like, you should see some of the movies he is inspired by and realize why, you know, he and Kurosawa really do kind of mirror each other in so many ways. And it is kind of wild how Francis Ford Coppola and George Lucas start doing tributes to Kurosawa's work. But I can't find anything on whether or not he actually ever met Kurosawa, despite being a huge fan.
But I have no idea. No,
I don't think he has.
He's just kind of admired him from afar. I don't hate AI, and I kind of can understand why he just kind of felt like he had to just do help out his friend and who he admired, Kubrick. But yeah. It's like, that's another movie. You really do struggle to find any interest in it.
I liked that movie up until the end. I think that movie,
I'm with you.
The coda was unnecessary. That movie probably would be on my list of top 10 favorite movies if the credits rolled when the light dimmed with the kid in the little submersible. And the light dims.
I'm with you.
Roll credits. Indeed. Greatest movie ever made.
Yeah, it's set.
But depressing.
It really is.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No denying that. But but don't leave without getting some cotton candy ending was just too much for me.
Yeah.
BBC,
that movie went on way too long.
BBC News did a survey saying it's like the 83rd most important movie since like 2000, but I'm like, I don't know.
I don't know about that.
I don't know about
that. Last time you heard people talking about it but us right now.
Yeah, it's true. It's not one that keeps coming up. It's not one you see, rebroadcast. It's not one that
you
see.
No, it's too long, too. There's so
much. It's true.
I don't know how you even cover up some of the more risque material. And at the same time, I don't even know if the ending would have changed any differently with Kubrick. I don't think they changed the script at all, and yet it might have been a little different, or maybe it was just too advanced to get it done in terms of that era. You know, we were just becoming too modernized by that point, you know?
Yeah. I've read that was indeed like Kubrick's ending, but it always felt like a Spielberg ending to me.
So there you go. That's why I just didn't mesh. But I mean, the art direction is definitely good, but yet I don't know. I've watched it a few times and I've always just struggled to finish it, and yet I've never regretted watching it. But at the same time, I mean, I kept kind of remembering about it because Stan Winston, you know, my favorite special effects guy, was involved with it.
Yeah.
So was Adam Savage from Mythbusters.
Oh, was he? Awesome. Nice.
There's actually a great video on YouTube of him visiting the Stanley Kubrick exhibit, and he talks about how Kubrick handed the project off to Spielberg. And he stops in front of some very early storyboard sketches that Kubrick did. And he said, "See, I recognize these because I saw them at Industrial Light of Magic."
Nice. Mark Kermode apparently apologized to Spielberg in an interview in 2013, saying, "I got it wrong. It's now his enduring masterpiece." This is also why I fucking hate Mark Kermode as a critic.
I could never stand him.
Such a twat. It's like, especially, how do you say Love Actually is the worst Christmas movie of all time? Like, fucking hell. Ugh.
Yeah, that movie, Artificial Intelligence, definitely didn't get better with time. I'll say it's one of the few movies that, as a kid, I loved it. And as I got older, I was just like, let's just put this on the top shelf. And just
I've never actually revisited. I've not revisited that film since I saw it the first time.
Yeah, I mean, it's still there on the top shelf. Looks nice, but you know, I'm not going to bring it down.
Yeah. Maybe if someone does a commentary or recut, but nah.
I'll pass.
Yeah, same.
You know, something about Spielberg that we've all said in one way or another is his sort of eclectic amount of genres that he's found himself directing, that he's not let himself get, as I said before, pigeonholed in one genre, which is something that a lot of directors do find themselves, either through choice of their own or just because that's what the industry will give him. And he's never allowed himself to do that. I mean, he's done every.
It could also be that his experiments have made money for the most part, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Very good point. Yeah. But he's I mean, he's done everything from the drama to the, you know, the epic period pieces, the war dramas, the adventures, the science fiction. He's tried his hand at some comedies. He reminds me of another director that I really admire for doing the same thing as Robert Wise.
That's a very good comparison, especially considering, you know, he was definitely in, you know, the black room, you know, messing with the film, seeing how to cut it and how it can make an impression based on when you cut away versus when you mm-hmm. don't. And yeah. Robert Wise was another one who just talked about, oh, you're a lucrative filmmaker and yet not as many films that we like. But it's like, no, he has a lot to applaud for. And then there's our others where it's like, not sure about that one. But yeah, I think that is a good comparison. I can't say it better. It's just you right. pretty much it. It's
well, like, yeah. I mean, Robert Wise, he did a lot of, you know, horror films in the 40s and science fictions in the 50s and musicals in the 60s and then revisited science fiction again in the 70s. He was just an amazing, just different types of films. And I think that people, you know, 50 years from now will be saying the same thing about Spielberg.
Yeah, I can't think why they wouldn't, but that is true. And more or less, it's just kind of interesting seeing someone evolve that way. I mean, yeah, with Wise, you know, he had The Haunting and Sound of Music, Star Trek the Motion Picture, and all these other movies. And it's like, yeah, I mean, Spielberg definitely never said any genre was beneath him. Never took
that. Yeah, exactly.
Sense. No.
And he loved all kinds of movies, so I'm sure he loved being scared. He loved being intrigued. He loved crying. he loved being excited. He got that, and I think that's why. So whenever I see anyone trash talking Spielberg, he's just like, "Yeah, well, you can't tell me there's not a single movie he's done that wasn't good at some point." You know, it's just like
right.
It's like saying you hate the Beatles.
Oh God, yeah. Telling me the Beatles are irrelevant, yeah, that's so not gonna fly.
Overrated. Yeah.
Overrated. Bloody hell.
Yeah, Spielberg's definitely made his missteps, and he's done things that are questionable. And that might be something what you could consider some of his cons, where sometimes maybe he doesn't think twice before doing something. I'm thinking of like the re-release of E.T. when he decided to go in and, you know, digitally remove shotguns and things like that because he thought it was too gross. Scary. Yeah.
Hanging out with George too much at that time.
it's very possible. I'm but yeah, so I think that was something he thought was a good idea and he didn't think again. And that's maybe a con of his.
Yeah,
I'm happy to say that cut is, you know, I just took my kids to see it at the drive-in about a month ago, and that it's the original cut.
Yeah, I think that one faded away. That went the way of New Coke, I think.
Low on diet. Oh man, so I'll wrap this up. I mean, anyone else just kind of want to just have some other closing thoughts on like what they would like to see him do in the future, like? I'd like to see him kind of do a Western because I always got that impression
of
the third Indiana Jones. And he's on the horse. That's as close as he gets to a Western.
That would be neat. It would just be fun to kind of see a resurgence in a Westerns period and get some of the modern filmmakers and do their take on it. Someone besides someone like Tarantino, which would just be a Western with a lot of F-bombs. And so for some reason... Yeah, why does your gunfighter not wear boots?
I'm sure that's why he probably hired Mangold for the new Indiana Jones. It's like, yeah, the guy does Westerns, whether they're neo-Westerns or just straight-up Westerns. The guy's been watching every kind of movie, whether it's Gary Cooper or John Ford or, you know, newer stuff. Why is Ready Player One so mixed depending on who you ask? I would have thought that would have...
Sorry, I actually like that one.
Yeah, I love Ready Player One.
And I always encounter at least one person who like really loathes it to death. Just fine, because I guess you could say he was diving into video game culture a little too easy. I mean,
that's the thing for me. I had flashbacks of being like really high on a couch in college and watching my friends play Final Fantasy. And I'm like, all right, this is cool, but I have zero emotional investment in this whatsoever. I don't care.
Well, fair enough. I mean,
all the Easter eggs are in that movie, by the way. All of them.
All of them.
Yeah, plenty of Easter eggs. I mean, really, I only connected with it when he gets to the club and just showing how the person literally doesn't have a life outside of the video game. So that just brought some interesting themes. And then having the cops look like the ones in Minority Report where the, you know, future helmets all over their heads scanning through. But I will give you this. It's kind of a ways away from him trying to make his equivalent of, you know, The Matrix or, you know, Inception. And then it's kind of interesting how, don't get me wrong, I fucking hated the trailer. I was just like, it just had.
That's why I didn't see it in the theater, actually.
I saw it in the theater reluctantly when I saw some good reviews from people I trust. But yeah, there were other ones where it's like, then Riff Tracks loves to like kind of team up on some of his blockbusters. He's like, no, bash some movie that's really boring. But don't get me wrong, it seems like the book is very hackneyed. So I guess that's part of the.
That's why. I couldn't finish the book, honestly.
Yeah, my sister usually is a purist about following the book, and she's like, it's fine, especially considering he gets mentioned multiple times in the book. So it's like, I probably wouldn't care either, but I don't think he's going to adapt any sequels or anything. It was just a one-off and done. I'm like, that's good. He doesn't need any more franchises. He's too good for a franchise.
Yeah. I would like to see, I'm a scary movie junkie, and I just want him to drop one more horror film.
Oh, yes.
Just one. I don't even care if it's bad. I just want his name on it.
Right. Or at least produce it or something. And come up with the cast.
I know that. Like, a whodunit film I like to see him do.
He could definitely do another Knives Out, you know, Ten Little Indians kind of movie. When I saw Bridge of Spies in the theater, we were just so wowed. It's like we were okay with some of the historical, you know, summaries, you know, blending characters, you know, multiple characters into one entity. It's like just how that movie opens up with all that kind of voyeuristic shot is like you feel like you're being spied on, the viewer, you know, and then you're looking at stuff that you shouldn't be watching. And just all those other lesser known actors who are just were phenomenal is like, and now they're bigger names and everyone goes, oh, yeah, he's in the guy from Bridge of Spies.
Oh. I tell you, I really enjoyed revisiting Close Encounters of the Third Kind for this podcast, because that's a movie I found really dull when I was young. But I got the Blu-ray from the library, and I think part of the problem was I was watching it on pan and scan VHS as a kid.
Yeah. So
watching that in widescreen was a whole new ball game.
That'll color anyone's opinion.
Definitely not seen any redone special edition of it. I've only seen the Good Times home video edition. So, I mean, and that was also rented from a library years ago. But yeah, it was one of those where it's like, I think my dad and I, we had seen it. And it was just like, yeah, I don't need to see it multiple times. But it was one of those, my sister wanted to see like an anniversary screening about a few years back. And I was just like, I got better things to spend my green on. You know, it's just like, but yeah. It is interesting how that one is kind of, that was kind of his, I guess you could say, double feature in a way. Is like, if you're not sure if you like Jaws or, you know, Duel on TV, you're definitely going to know whether you're a fan or not if you get this Close Encounters. And I guess it is kind of funny how everyone always mentions Duel. It's probably, I guess, the biggest 70s TV movies of that era. Because it's like, all the other ones you kind of think is like, I saw it, but it wasn't necessarily good. And it's like, he took a big, big premise and made it very suspenseful. And it's kind of wild how Sugarland Express kind of gets glossed over, because that was his attempt at doing a true crime kind of movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When do you get to see Atherton as the hero?
Right?
True.
Not playing a douchebag for once. I've been to parts of San Antonio, so I definitely see that, you know, in the movie itself, because that's where they filmed it. You know, wouldn't it make sense otherwise, Sugarland. But, it's kind of an underrated, that in Munich, I think, are some of John Williams' more underrated scores, along with one for his Oliver Stone movies. And I think that's in and of itself, too. It's just so cool. I really do wish people would venture out and see more of John Williams' scores, and realizes mm-hmm. like, no, the dude has done more than just Star Wars for a billion years. He's like, no, he's done all these other kind of events besides, you know, the Olympics. He really has done so many different kinds of moods. And I when Spielberg doesn't use him, that's fine too. He really does kind of, you can tell he's in the projector room looking at it, seeing what other people are going to see. Oh, thank you all so much for being on here, and I will let you plug your various podcasts. So, James, let's talk about Honest Reviews.
Yeah, Honest Reviews is just a movie rating podcast for the most part, just because I've watched so many like good movies, great movies, but then I've watched movies like, I don't know if you guys seen the movie like The Witch, where professional critics will say like these movies are great movies, and then I'll watch it and be like, ah, this movie's not that so good. And then I'll watch movies that are like great, like even as we're going through Spielberg's list of movies, I was looking at some of the ratings and some of them are like 7.1s and 7.2s, and I'm like, who's rating these movies? Like, these are classic easy 8 movies. So that's pretty much what my podcast is about, is getting things right and getting it out there to the community.
Yeah, and it's hard to not feel that way too, because you'll see so many other IMDb guys complaining, and it'll take you a while to get to a negative review that is kind of well thought out. You got to get through all the other ones that are just people bitching on their iPhone, you know?
Yeah.
Or neo-Nazis saying it's too politically correct. It makes me feel bad because I'm one of these assholes in the movie.
Right.
Ken, what podcast are you appearing on next?
None, but I'll be listening to a bunch.
Get back on PsyOps.
I wish.
You can do it. Mr. Page, what's next on Time Shifter?
All right, yeah, Time Shifters podcast. You know, we're on all the available platforms, where you can just go to timeshifterspodcast.com. Next up for us is going to be the next episode you'll hear would be the one you're going to be on.
Yeah!
Where we talked about, I already forgot what film, what the heck was it called? Oh, Operation Kid Brother. Yeah.
Oh, man.
And then we're also, and then the episode after that, we're also in we're bouncing back and forth between the MST3K Unrift, and we're also doing some 70s and 80s made for TV movies. So we're good. So it's been a fun year. And you could also find me if you go to orphanentertainment.com. I have another podcast, and we do nothing there but review public domain films. Yeah. And that's a lot of fun. So we're going back to the beginnings of all the Hollywood, you know, all the tropes that we're so used to today. Well, we're looking at the films that started it all, and it's been right.
It kind of makes you look at stuff like Ron Howard's Far and Away. It's like, this would be great if it was in black and white and made years ago as the African Queen. You know, this is that kind of movie. It's like, it just doesn't. The melodrama in that just doesn't work in other kinds of movies nowadays.
Well, we're going back even further than that. I mean, we're into the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and back when black and white, you know, meant something.
Right. It's not just to get an Oscar nom now.
I love Star Wars as much as the next guy, but cinema did not start with Star Wars.
Exactly.
Watch old movies.
Oh my God.
Yes, exactly. It's so nice going back and watching, and you're finding the earliest that you can find of like this particular kind of character. Like, oh my gosh, this is that person that you see in every film. Here they are at 1931 or whatever.
Oh man. And Austin, what is the Ronin Geek up to?
Yeah, I mean, primarily we do a lot of gaming stuff. We also cover some movies. I think lately the movie stuff has been kind of relegated to me falsely trying to convince the other two guys, Rob and Adam, that Battle Angel Alita is the greatest film ever made, which they do not enjoy. But every single episode about that, and it's just it's like one of those movies that I just keep watching over and over, because I'm like, how did this get made? Like, how did this even happen? And
John will not be listening to your podcast. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, honestly, we're trash. Don't even listen, man. And
I couldn't do it, but it is kind of funny how that was another one. Is like it divided everyone, and I knew something was up when my pal Tony, who's into anime, was like, "Nope."
Oh my god!
Hate sci-fi wanted to go and see that. I was like, "For real? Okay." This has a weird marketing. Marketing is so fucked up nowadays.
If you ever do an episode on that, I want on, man. I could talk about the movie for days.
I'm fearing I might piss off all the steampunk anime crowds. We might do it again if we talk about James Cameron, though. So I'll get you on for that one. How about
it? Okay, maybe we'll get you on a Ronin Geek episode so we could just rail on the other guys about it. That's my favorite part. But honestly, yeah, it is a not safe for work podcast, and I realize listening to you guys, I have a lot of movie podcasts I need to catch up on because your guys' knowledge is unbelievable. So I gotta listen in a little bit more. And then one more plug: I am part of the duo along with Haz Wild from Brief Burrito Podcast. We have an app called Cephalopod, and all of your podcasts are on there. And we would love for you to claim your podcasts on there. And it's a monetization platform as well. And just a cool little app to check out. And I would love anybody to hop on and check it out and message me on Twitter and let me know what you think of it.
Should you? Please. Feel free to link that as well.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
And John, what are you reviewing next on the Action Elite?
Oh, as I've always said, every time I'm on here, it's usually just very random with my reviews. Although, I might review one that you sent me a few days ago called Tripwire. So,
oh yeah, an obscure bomber movie with David Warner and a then unknown Viggo Mortensen as a terrorist. And hell, you're such a fan of it. I'm surprised you haven't reviewed the show Barry.
I should actually at this point.
Do it. Sorry to sound like the Emperor.
Do it.
All right, Danny boy, what beverages and other obscure terror movies are you reviewing in your leisure?
Well, I'm actually waiting on a attachable DVD player for my laptop so I can start using footage from some of the stuff that Horrorpack sent me.
Oh, nice.
And I got the Undertaker wine review coming up. I'm still doing footage for that.
Perfect. He does like to sneak in some wrestling retrospects, which are very cool. I can't wait for anyone to hear our take on best wrestlers that got into acting, because we did so many we did so many honoraries, and then we did so many dishonorable mentions, like, what the fuck, Randy Couture and Kurt Angle? You guys should have been the next Bruce Willis, and you're doing all this unwatchable garbage.
Hashtag Hulk Hogan in a tutu.
We did talk a shit ton about Hulk Hogan, right, Piper? So there's going to be a lot of stuff that appeals to everybody, whether they want to listen to just the bits about The Rock and Batista or all the other stuff. But yeah, it was so much fun, and it sucks so much afterwards because Justin Uberholzer, you know, he reviews any movie that stars a wrestler, whether it's a cameo or is them as an extra. And then Podbean took down his podcast because of an obscure music copyright claim, and I'm like, fuck, do you want me to light up their email? Just tell them what idiots they are. Oh, man. Alrighty. So thank you all. This was I can't remember the last time that we've had 7 people on here. So that's great.
It's been a great time. It's great talking to everybody. And thanks for inviting me.
I try our best to not be overcrowded and at the same time, just have it be a forum. And thank you all for really just firing away and just showing the appeal of a person who's going to be introduced to every era.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks. Nice meeting you guys.
We'll return after these messages.
Hey, feeling down? Feeling low? Not enough podcasts about movies in your life? Why not try?
They must be destroyed on sight!
The new podcast cure-all, sure to get you right with the world and on a path to better living. We have exploitation, we have Italian horror, we have zombies, we have slashers, we have crime films, we have spaghetti westerns, we even have sci-fi and sex comedies. So take a dose of...
They must be destroyed on sight!
As needed, and let the hosts, Lee Russell, Daniel Harper, Paul Romali, and the odd guest host Cure What Ails Ya.
Warning, may cause atrophy, African consumption, black fever, bone shave, chin puff, colic, cramp colic, dropsy of the brain, elephantitis, grocer's itch, jaundice, mania, miasma, mortification, palsy, Pox disease, rheumatism, scurvy, St. Anthony's fire, summer complaint, and worm fit in some people. Consult a physician before listening.
Hey, I heard you like movies.
I heard you like to hustle.
I heard you like podcasts.
Well, guess what?
There's a podcast for you out there called The Home Video Hustle.
Damn right.
Every Friday, we talk about whatever movie PJ picks out the bag. What does that mean? Every Wednesday on our YouTube page, I put a bunch of movies in a bag, and PJ picks one out at random. And then we just watch it. We talk about it for maybe like an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours, whatever we feel like doing, wherever the conversation leads us.
But do we actually talk about the movie?
Most of the time.
Ah.
Tangents galore.
Yes.
So believe me, we may be a movie podcast, but it's not always about movies. We might talk about video games.
Mm-hmm.
Music. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the big one, music. Sometimes we might get a little bit of politicalness in there.
Yes.
Sometimes we may just, oh, you know what we like to do? We like to tell stories, PJ.
Ah, yes.
I am the master storyteller of the podcast realm. Undefeated. So if you like to hear about movies, video games, whatever foolishness comes to our mind, the most random stuff you can think of, check out the Home Video Hustle. You can find us on the Stitchers.
Yes.
The Google Play.
Yes.
Apple Podcasts.
What else?
Podbean.
What else?
Podcast Addict.
Goddamn.
All that. Ain't no reason you can't get your hustle on. We everywhere. Worldwide, baby.
Hustle, motherfucker. Hustle.
Hey, we can't cuss in the promo, PJ.
Ah.
We gotta be family friendly. There may be podcasts out there that don't want his hair to say
ah.
All that good fun stuff.
Well, you.
don't run the listeners away, PJ.
Ah, I'm sorry.
But this is going kind of long.
Yes.
So we'll end this and say, hey, check out the Home Video Hustle every Friday on all the various podcast outlets. Peace.
Peace.
As far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster. And while Witch didn't make it to the top of the world, he did make the Gangs of Hollywood podcast. So join the gang and enjoy a movie review podcast about movie gangs, gangsters, mobsters, and the mayhem they cause. You can find GOH Podcast on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. At GOHpod, at www.gohpod.com, as well as your favorite podcast listening app. And remember, say hello to your little friend for me.
If you take two old punk rockers who are past their prime, put them in front of a movie screen and give them a podcast, what do you get? Cinema Punks. Cinepunks. It's the mixtape of movies.
Did you ever see a film at such a young age it left you traumatized with cinematic wounds?
Necrophilia.
It's a dead issue, man. Don't push it. Cinema Psyops is a weekly podcast documenting an ongoing experiment on the mind of an unwilling test subject.
No one should have to watch this movie.
Oh, no one should have to watch this?
No one should have to watch this movie.
Surprisingly, it's not a topic that a lot of people really want to tackle.
I'm shocked, prudes.
I know, really.
Right?
It's the next sexual frontier that no one wants to explore.
I am, in the most sincerest of senses, disappointed in you.
It takes a powerful goddess like Connie, jam her arm down the monster's throat and kill it. Oh, I'm still tripping out over that. Even as a kid, I was like, I gotta find a girl like that.
Every week, I get a new look of disappointment that I never thought I could get out of.
It's unimaginable. At 12 years old, you should not be watching this movie.
Obviously.
At 13, you should not be. 14, you shouldn't be. I'm not entirely sure even 17-year-olds should be watching this movie.
Just because you're offended by something doesn't mean that you have the right to demand that it doesn't exist.
Watching this film again, I had all of this, like, little nerd glee with everything that kept
little history
up.
Doll yeah, popping up
absolutely.
At you.
So I totally loved this film.
Hey, I know why you know, couldn't see that. It's because your brain's warped watching this shit at 12 years old.
Yeah, this is a rough movie. I told you ahead of time when we were getting ready to do it that it was going to be a rough
movie. How did you watch this shit at 12?
Because physical wounds heal, cinematic ones don't. Listen to Cinema Psyops.
Hey everybody, I'm Corey.
And I'm Zach, and we're the hosts of Podcasting After Dark, a cast dedicated to late-night horror and sci-fi of the 80s and 90s, often found on HBO and Cinemax.
You know, the movies your parents didn't want you watching as a kid. You can find us every other week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, and Stitcher.
This is what you want.
This is what you get.
It's late, it's time, let's check our cue, baby. Pair it with a couple brews, baby. We love good movies. We love the bad ones too. So we watch them all and pass their lessons on to you. Oh yeah.
Bana 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 bana.
Everything I learned from movies helps to make life a little bit groovy. With a one-liner plot holes and gratuitous movies, it's time to get busy with your friend Steven Izzy
at EILFM.podbean.com.
Hi everybody, it's Mac Jackson. I wanted to invite you to a new site called the Forever Adventure Network. This website has everything. Pictures, videos, blogs. There's original music by Harmony Constant. Two podcasts. One is the MacGyver podcast, where we celebrate Richard Dean Anderson, his iconic roles, and how it's influenced our lives. There's episode discussions, interviews, and life conversations. The second podcast is the Never Gets Old podcast, where we celebrate all the best things that we love in life, from TV, movies, music, and comics. The site is also the home for the MacGyver SG-1 audio series, an ongoing adventure series that continues the adventures of MacGyver and SG-1. There are also multiple stores to choose from for all of your pop culture and adventure needs. Come on by and check us out today. And thanks for joining the adventure.
We now continue with our program.
Follow us on the web on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is available on Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor, Apple, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Feel free to review our show and leave comments on any of those sites. Thanks a million for listening. It's a jack.